along to the RTE Rugby Podcast. The couch is full this morning. Bernard Jackman is with me as usual. And also with us this morning, Brendan Fanning. Brendan, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
There's a very specific reason we got you in today. Aside from your, you know, decades of wisdom on Irish rugby, but you've put those decades to good use. You've a new book out this week. Tell us about it. Touching Distance, Irish Rugby's Battle with Great Expectations.
Yes.
What's the short little pitch?
The pitch is, way back when you were in short trousers in 2007, I wrote a book called From There to Here, which charted Ireland's mad transition from amateurism to professionalism. And I was lucky in that there were any number of really good stories of the chaos and the craziness. So it kind of made sense to follow it up at some point, as in, okay, if we always had growth potential, and I always thought we would be good if we ever took professionalism seriously. And it took a long time for us to do that. So it made sense to circle around again and say, well, okay, 15, 20 years on, how good did we get? And we've obviously got very good. So hence the title, that we're in touching distance of getting where we want to be. I guess the obstacle that we can't quite get over is the last four of a World Cup. Mm. But there's lots of other good stuff in between. And the book tries to put manners on that period post-2007, when I signed off the first book, and this kicks off with the World Cup in 2007 in France with Eddie O'Sullivan, and runs through to pretty much where we are now.
Less chaos than the first book, yeah?
Yeah, less chaos, more order, and once the IRFU took the handbrake off and said, okay, look, we're going to have to get on board with this, they became quite good at it, and then huge game changers, like bringing in David Nucifora as a high performance director, bringing in somebody like Joe Schmidt. And then along the way, obviously with the number of changes you're going to get in pro sport, you're going to have some very interesting characters coming in along the way, and some ups and downs and ins and outs and all that.
Plenty of great little nuggets in it. And you mentioned like David Nucifora coming in. And one I do just want to mention, because as you said, when your first book would have come out, I still would have been in short pants. Still am. I still wear shorts pretty much every day. But, you know, just a couple of nuggets that people might not realise. This is long before I ever would have been covering the game here. But you're talking about just before David Nucifora coming in. It's the first couple of pages of his chapter. And one little nugget that blew me away was, for example, you say, one of the weapons in the IRFU torture chamber was the National Team Review Group, a body of men whose remit extended to sitting down the night before test matches with the coach of the day to grill him on the plan, on what the plan was for the following afternoon. And that went on up until the early days of Joe Schmidt. We're talking 2013, 2014, where the head coach had to sit down and basically say, here's what we're going to do tomorrow.
Do you have a look of astonishment on your face? Do you remember this?
I knew of it, but I thought it had gone before 2013, to be honest.
Okay, I referred earlier to the handbrake being up.
Yeah.
Okay, so its roots are in that the fellas who were big, big hitters in their day, the Sid Millers and Noel Murphys and those guys who were absolute legends of the Irish game and the Lions game, they were the people who shaped and drove Irish rugby, and they were the people whose ideals were offended by professionalism. So they found it very hard to let go. They really did know their rugby. You would have huge respect for these guys as rugby men and how the game should be played, etc. So they thought it was a pretty natural step to sit Neil Tracy down when he came in as head coach and said, well, what's your plan for tomorrow?
Well, I mean, if I was coaching Ireland, I'd expect someone to be doing that for me. But not if it was Joe Schmidt coming in after winning 300 cups.
But it drove Warren Gatland insane. And some of the people who were asking Warren Gatland.
And 12 years later, it was still going.
Yeah, I remember, it's kind of unrelated, but I remember a press conference after Brian Ashton. And Brian Ashton had a pretty dismal series of car crashes in his year in charge. And he was asked by one of my colleagues, what's the plan? This was not an IRFU guy, this was a journo, saying to him, will we be flashing it to the wings? I thought Ashton was going to cry. So it was from the same school of thought that you were getting fellas who were well removed from the game. Even though they were legends, the game had changed out of sight. And they were sitting down, the head coach, saying, well, what will he be doing? And the natural extension of that would be, if they didn't agree with it, they'd say, oh no, that's not going to work. So that stopped when Lucifora came in.
Where would you say we've seen the biggest change, though, in those last, 18 years since the last book?
Well,
the freedom kind of of high performance, getting so like getting a David Nusafora character in. Is it around the school's game? Is it?
It's all of those things. And it's, but just to give you an idea of where it was, in 1997, Ireland had a chaotic tour of New Zealand and Samoa, a development tour which Brian Ashton took. And I was down doing the Lions, and I moved, wrapped up the Lions and hopped over to New Zealand to pick up the last four games of that tour. And I'll never forget walking into the hotel and Brian Ashton, whom I knew a little bit by that stage, already had an ashen-faced look. And he kind of beckoned me over and he said, "You want to come up for a chat?" So he went up to his room and he said, "They won't give me the four squads." He was trying to get four squads of 25. And he had agreed with the IRFU that they would give him four squads, provincial squads of 25. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Now they're rowing back on this and they're slowing it down. I don't know what to do." So I laugh now. I wasn't laughing then. Yeah. I laugh now looking back on it. So those days are gone and we have four professional squads. We have four academies of varying quality. We have a runaway production line going in Leinster, which is feeding the rest of the country. That is functional, but not healthy, mm-hmm. because it's so...
Which we'll probably even get to a little bit later on, okay, I imagine.
Which is so lopsided. And we've had a couple of people who've done an unbelievably good job. I had issues with some of what Lucifora did. Joe Schmidt was a game changer. Mm-hmm. And he arrived at just the right time. So in the midst of all this, we start winning things at provincial level, and Munster kicked it off and rugby, I used to, way back at the start, Neil, I used to say, geez, am I going to be able to get a full-time career out of this? Yeah. Am I going to have to start writing about stuff I know even less about? And luckily, it came round and it took off. And rugby is now a genuinely big business in this country.
I don't know, have you read this yet, Birch?
Yeah, I've read it, yeah.
Your name pops up in it a couple of times as well here and
there.
Well,
in fairness, I went through, that's my era. Well, obviously the last 5 or 6 years aren't, but I was... under Brian Ashton, I missed that tour to New Zealand. I had a groin operation, so I would have been on that. Tour of Hell, it was called. The group were split in two. Brian Ashton, his first day, spoke about playing this expansive rugby, and then we had to train in ALSA, and he could see quite quickly, I think, our skill set and our fitness levels weren't up to it. We used to train on a Wednesday. Most of the team would fly in from England on their day off, and we'd meet in the morning in the hotel, and we'd go out and train in ALSA, and we'd train for 3 or 4 hours, and then poor lads had to go back on a Thursday and train with our clubs. Like it was mental. Now obviously that's the very early stage of professional rugby, but this brings it all the way through. And I think what Brendan has over most other journalists is obviously a network and many people who spoke on and off the record. Mm-hmm. Just gives you another layer of information. Like there's lots of autobiographies out this summer, not this Christmas, and there'll be good books, but if you're interested in how we've got to where we are now, this kind of maps out all the significant milestones and, as I said, has interviews with people who, with the passing of time, are happy to talk. And it gives another layer of, I suppose, information. But, yeah, I think, look, if you're close to the game, you know a lot of this stuff. But a lot of fans will be shocked and interested in kind of the things that have happened in the background, I think.
Yeah, and, like, obviously, Brendan, it kind of covers all the key components of the last 17 years, whether it's the four provinces, the various international and some provincial coaches who've kind of come in and out and their stories, like Sir David Nusafora then as well. The women's and the sevens are across it also. I think you said towards the end of it, spoke to around 100 or so people.
Yeah.
Over the course of the... How long was this book in the work specifically?
I was messing around with it for a while and then I was made redundant from the Sunday Indo about 15 months ago, 16 mm-hmm. months ago. And the silver lining of that cloud was that it freed up a bit of time. So I was able to give it a turbo charge. So I suppose door to door, 12 months.
Yeah. So what do you do? What's next?
What's next is to try and flog it, because there's a forest of books, forest of rugby books out there at the moment that Birch is referred to. So flog that and then take a breather and, I don't know, I'll figure out something next, you know, whenever.
As I mentioned, all the various people you spoke to, a long list of people. Now, you don't list off who they are. I understand that pretty much the one person you couldn't get your hands on was the man himself, Andy Farrell.
Yeah. I'd hoped to get him. I knew nothing of his book, and neither did our publishers, Gill, and neither did most other people. So I spent 3 months that I can't get back chasing him via his coterie of assistants and getting various, you know, there's a cloud in the sky today, we won't be able to answer that question or whatever. And then it emerged that he had his own book coming out. So then everything became clear. Clearly he wasn't going to cooperate.
Give away the trade secrets to you.
So Graham Rowntree has signed an NDA going out of Munster, obviously, so he couldn't cooperate. But thankfully, everybody else did. And Lucy Fora significantly did not sign an NDA, which to my mind is unique in recent years of guys leaving the IRFU. I could be wrong in that. Also, Eddie Jones I found really informative. I'd no experience of him before. I'd never spoken to the guy. I didn't know if I would be able to get him, and he was very helpful. And I thought it was fascinating that he said that when we were talking about Joe, he's a big fan of Joe Schmidt. And at the time I spoke to him, Neil, he was reading a book by Carlo Ancelotti on winning and leadership. And Ancelotti made the point that the thing that gets you the gig in the first place is the thing that gets you sacked. And Eddie said, I absolutely 100% agree with that. He says, I think that's what did for Joe. And he says, and then there was a pause in the conversation and he goes, and that's what it'll do for Andy as well. Now, we had that conversation 12 months ago, just around the time of the November series. And funny, Lucy Fora didn't think that. Lucy Fora is a massive fan of Farrell and thinks Farrell has the ability, if not to reinvent himself, because to reinvent himself would probably involve losing all the things that makes him evidently such a good coach. But he's able to flick a few different buttons and tweak a few things and change direction to keep himself relatively fresh. We'll see how that goes. So maybe that isn't what's going to get him sacked. Maybe he won't be sacked. Maybe he'll be able to walk out. Maybe he'll be in the minority of coaches who say, I'm done with this now. I've done it for, you know, 7, 8, 9 years. I mean, he came in 2016. He's here a while.
Well, it's funny, like you say, the one of the few coaches to be able to walk out and say, I've done it and leave on a high. That would have been the plan with Joe Schmidt. And I think we all assumed that's what was going to happen. And maybe in a few years' time, we'll look back and say Joe Schmidt was able to leave on a high. But at the time, it didn't really seem that way.
When I spoke to Joe again, it was late last year in the November series when he was over here with the Aussies. And he'd been non-committal. I had always got on with him. And we had a good working relationship. And I wasn't sure. He was giving me the, as Joe likes to do, not to commit to anything up front. Yeah, I'll see how I'm fixed. I've got a lot of charity stuff on. I've got a lot of this. I've got a lot of that. So anyway, when I got him, it was a very meaty, chunky interview, during which it became evident that he was quite sore about the way it had finished and what some of the players had said on the way out. And then he had said, and, you know, players then contacted me privately and said, oh, I didn't mean that. You know, I was at a gig and I had a few drinks on. Jeez, I shouldn't have said that. This kind of stuff. But he was hurt by the exit.
Yeah.
And I was struck by it at the time because I remember Lucy Fora pretty much throwing him under the bus at the review of that World Cup. And Joe would have understood that, I think, at the time. But what I didn't know was at the 2019 World Cup in Japan, and he says it in the book, I walked into my hotel room and I felt I shouldn't be here. That mentally he wasn't in the right place. He had carried baggage, Neil, over the death of his dad. And he deals with this in his own, or dealt with it in his own book. He was in Auckland at the time. He was with the Blues. They were playing an away game in Super Rugby. His dad was very ill. He thought he'd be able to get through the game and whatever, fly home and get back home in time. And he didn't. So that was a screw in his head. So then his mother was very ill in the lead up to the World Cup in Japan, and he was going to make damn sure that didn't happen. So he was back and forth to New Zealand three times during that period, which was mentally and physically enervating. So by the time he walked in the door, and the team had gone, we were over the top by that stage. And he must have known that. So when he walked into the hotel room and started a World Cup, he's gone, oh. So I was delighted he was telling me this from a journal point of view. Mm-hmm. And then, which was very instructive, at the end of the conversation, Joe felt that he'd given me too much. And he goes, oh, you got a good interview there. And I said, yeah, cheers, Joe. I appreciate that. Thanks very much. And he says, that was just between us. And I said, Joe. So I'm not going to tell you exactly what followed, but it was pretty, it would need to be bleeped out. And then immediately I said, look, you knew the ground rules. And they said, yeah, okay. It's just, I just feel like I've put a lot of myself out there. And I said, yeah, you did. And great, I'll be fair to you. And thank you very much for your time. So
polish out a few of the swear words or something, was it? Or?
Well, no, come swear words. Go, Joe didn't curse. Not much, anyway.
What happens in 2 years then when Ireland do win the World Cup? Do you do an updated version or bring out a new one entirely?
I'll hand over to young guns like you, Neil. You can take the good bits out of that, and you can stitch them into your own book.
The book I could write with the stuff Bernie Jackman tells us off the record.
Don't forget the NDA sign. Yeah.
The one last little bit on it, actually, it was kind of towards the last couple of chapters when you are talking a little bit more about Andy Farrell and Stuart Lancaster, but it's kind of interesting. The relationship between the pair.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Just business-like relationship.
Yeah. Well, Bersh would have known this, but this would be one of the things he doesn't tell you.
Yeah.
But I only discovered this when talking to a really good source in this book. And it struck me at the time that Lancaster deserves some credit for the way Ireland are playing because Leinster were Ireland in green at one point or to a certain extent. And I would have thought, seeing as himself and Farrell were together in 2015, there'd be a bit of, cheers, mate, you're doing a great job.
Yeah.
You know, thanks very much. I would have expected, I would have expected Nusi Fora to be swinging by UCD and saying, by the way, I know it's not in your job spec, but really delighted with what you're doing. This is really working out very well for us. But no, he was never seen. And then I was told Andy had the hump that Stuart was getting the credit, or some of the credit, for the way Ireland were playing. Mm. And it was on no uncertain terms. No. Andy was, his nose was right out of joint that Stuart Lancaster was being credited for the stuff that Andy felt he was doing 100%. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's well worth a read anyway. I'll give it another plug at the end, Touching Distance by Brendan Fanning. Tomorrow, Thursday, officially in the bookshops?
Yeah, I'd say you could order it now, but yeah, today, tomorrow, whatever.
Good stuff. We'll move on to the week that was, because what a week it was, Bernard. We've Leinster 14, Munster 31, Sharks 26, Ulster 34, bonus point win down in South Africa for Ulster, and Connacht almost pulling off a complete heist against the Bulls, finished 28-7-28, two losing bonus points for Connacht there. But we have to start at Croke Park. Leinster 14, Munster 31. I'll go right in with it because we're a few days on from the match, so we can start picking up maybe some of the broader points of it. The one element of the game that really seemed to be irking Leo Cullen after the match, he had 11 newly minted Lions out there from the summer, some of them playing their second match, some playing their first. Very few of them looked up to the pace of the game. A couple of them did all right, but I think by and large, they did not hit the heights whatsoever. But yeah, Tadhg Byrne was the best player on the pitch, and Leo Cullen was asked directly about that. Did it disappoint him to see that Munster had one line and he was so clearly head and shoulders above everyone out there? And he said, yeah, it did. It disappointed him.
Yeah, and we found out afterwards that Tadhg Byrne had an elbow operation.
Elbow operation in the summer as well.
So
yeah.
He missed even more of his prep. But I think what you saw with Tadhg Byrne was he came determined to play his role and be a dominant figure. And I think a lot of the Leinster players didn't step up and reach that emotional level that you need to win a test match like encounter. And across the board, Munster won a lot of those individual battles hands down, despite Leinster players opposite them being part of the Irish squad that's going to Chicago, British and Irish Lions, etc. So on paper, it looked like Leinster had way too much for Munster, but the Munster players had a game plan, had an attitude about them, had a fitness level that obviously meant that they could defend for as long as they did and such difficult periods as they had to defend and not give up. I thought it was an unbelievable performance, but I think Leinster have to be critical of themselves that they didn't get to that level. And that's what Leo is obviously touching on. He's also, I thought he was maybe a bit messaging towards his own S&C program, how, you know, they haven't been ready in reading the four games. You know, they've won one, but they certainly looked undercooked, undercooked physically in South Africa, but maybe emotionally. They just look way off, you know what I mean? And that makes you look like physically you're not ready. Because, let's be honest, this isn't the first preseason that Leinster have done, that Leo Cullen has done, his S&C team have done. His vast experience, coaching staff have been together for a long time now. I know that you have to, it's been a particularly difficult one with Lions players, etc. But there's a tried and trusted way of getting players to the level. And the RFU, they need James Ryan, Josh van der Fleer, Dan Sheen, etc. ready in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So, like, you can, I mean, it's very strange that they wouldn't be ready physically. Very strange. And I don't know, I just didn't think Leinster looked on the same page, really, and didn't adapt. Obviously, the first 10 minutes, the whole game, the scrum was dominant. They got a very soft try.
So they had the platform. That was the incredible
platform.
Part
and, yeah. and look, they had what Leinster are. All the statistics mirror what Leinster normally do, which is get a lot of red zone entries, and then everything back converted. They weren't able to convert it. But for me, they were way too loose from the 10th to the 40th minute. And then it seems at halftime, they decided to just go back to the power game, which, you know, it should work because they are more powerful in theory. But then it became too narrow and 2-1 out. And once Munster were up for the fight there and had the capacity to challenge them through counter-rooking, choking, jackals, holding them up over the line, realistically, like being there, Leinster just needed to throw three passes and they're in the corner a few times. And that's normal. I mean, Munster had to squeeze up. But Leinster became very lacking the confidence to go do that. And again, if you're the team with all those internationals, how can you be lacking confidence? But they were, and I think it's another harsh review for Leinster. Not like the Sharks, you can forget about the South African trip, but this is up there with Northampton, La Rochelle, Toulouse, etc., where they need to be better, and they didn't perform at the level they're capable of.
When you say you can forget about the South African trip, you'd also said you found it strange that they looked off physically and emotionally. And that was like, they knew what the fixture was way out, and they knew that the Lions were going to be away from that way out. And they knew that in the rearview mirror, park the Bulls in the final for a moment last season and let's go back to Northampton. So that was still, that bad smell was still hanging around. And you think, okay, we're going with the kids to South Africa. We really need to be absolutely on our game. We need to have them in the best condition possible in order to make an early season statement. And then that happened. And then the Munster game arrived and, okay, decent start. And then everything was just off. Everything.
I think the worrying thing, Bren, if you're a Leinster fan, is Leinster have always been a fairly consistent side. You know, under Lancaster, and in fairness, last year since Lancaster left, 2 years, they have been pretty consistent. They struggled to get up for the next level and to bring that performance, you know, when they have to find another gear. But probably, you know, Stormers really bad, Bulls better because there's a knee-jerk reaction, there's a bit of fight there. Sharks, not a good team, but Leinster blew them away, looked sharp, and then this week, or Saturday, in Croke Park, a big underperformance. Now, Munster exploited that and you know, led into that underperformance. But realistically, that's the challenge for them. And now those players who played, most of them are gone. So that's the challenge for Cullen. He was very frustrated post-match.
I might actually kind of... I've jotted down a few of the quotes here because One of the things you mentioned in your book, and it's something we've a lot of us who've been covering that beat have said for years, that when Leo Cullen, after a bad defeat, Leo Cullen has a strong habit of continuing the answer long after the question has been answered. And you can get a lot of big, long, waffly answers. Sometimes I would assume it's just to run down the clock a little bit and buy himself a little bit of time. I found it really interesting on Saturday, being in the press conference room in Croke Park, how pointed some of his answers actually were, because it really felt like he was trying to send a message across to his team. Some of the things he said here, it's a good wake-up call for the group. He's talking about Munster. Like, a lot of the time he struggles to... I've thrown him a few softball questions before after games against Munster, and he struggled to kind of give them a compliment. They defended and scrapped for everything. I thought we responded quite well against the Sharks, but Sharks didn't offer the same test as what Munster offered today. I heard Clayton talk about hard work, grit, determination. They showed that in spades, didn't they? Whereas we were second in hard work, grit and determination.
That one there, yeah. That just that line on its own,
yeah,
is almost, and we were talking about Brian Ashton earlier on, and he was down in history for saying...
It's sending a direct message back to the players.
Way back then, Ashton said, after we had blown a game against Scotland, he said, I don't know whose game that plan that was, but it wasn't mine. Which was the end of him in the dressing room. And that's Leo saying directly, well, indirectly, because it's via you, not directly in the dressing room. But that's, I imagine him saying, I'm going in to do the media now, and by the way, lads, I'm going to throw you under the bus.
Yeah. And... You know, he was asked, obviously, as well, about which will kind of lead into, I know what it's like missing out on national squads and having a bit of a chip on the shoulder, which you see with a lot of the Munster guys today, but it was good for our guys to see that, not that they should have been surprised by it. And it leads me to the point, 21 Leinster players gone away with this Ireland squad now at the moment. Birch, if you were Leo Cullen and the chunk of those Leinster-Ireland internationals who, and Lions, well, mainly the Lions probably crowd as well, who didn't hit the heights on Saturday, it presents a really interesting picture, because if they go out and they're flat again for Ireland and Ireland really have a stinker against New Zealand, then things are, it's looking like a long month for Ireland. But if those players are suddenly excellent against New Zealand, what's Leo Cullen thinking?
Well, he's thinking, what does he need to do to get them to play to that level? For Leinster. And because this is like, it's early season, but Leinster are going to come up against teams who are as good as Munster were on Saturday again. They need to be able to find a way to beat them, or else it'll be very difficult for Leo to last. That's the reality there. I mean, at some stage, Leinster are going to have to start fulfilling the potential they have. And a URC every couple of years isn't a fitting reward for the talent they have. Like, it's a very, very talented squad, well-supported, all that stuff. So they do have to, unfortunately, the pressure's now on to win trophies. And to win trophies, you'd like to see a better ability to handle what was put in front of them on Saturday and to find a way to win. If you think about what McMillan's been delighted with over the first three games, is Scarlett's was a very dominant performance. But the second and third game, where they were far from impressive, was they found a way to win. Mm-hmm. And they came into this game with confidence. And unfortunately for Leinster, by losing to them and the manner in which they lost and the underperformance, it's given fuel to this belief in Munster that they've turned a corner. And that's a dangerous thing. Leinster beat Munster a lot of times over the last few years because Munster didn't really believe that they were fit to be on the same field as them. And that's the truth. I've spoken to some ex-players who said, you know, coming up on the bus or whatever, looking at the team sheets, they realised that Leinster had far more talent. And now those Munster players who don't have the same accolades that Leinster have, they've beaten them once in a significantly important game. Mm-hmm. And they have a new coach and they have a new set of belief, etc. And seem to have a really good team spirit. Everyone's aligned. So now you've made it harder for yourself because you've given others belief that you're beatable. Like on Northampton, they spoke about it after the game last year in the semi-final. They looked back and showed the players previous cock-ups by Leinster in knockout games. And they wanted to expose that, what they say is a mental frailty. Now, whether that's a mental frailty or not, if your opposition believes that you're mentally frail,
it may as well be.
Yeah, well, it just gives them an extra...
It doesn't actually matter whether it's true or not.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. And unfortunately, at the moment, Leinster can't say that they have... Like, you look at Toulouse. Toulouse have a record of getting to finals and converting. You know, Leinster have a record of getting to knockout stages and not being able to close the deal. They'll argue the Bulls is different, whatever. But in terms of the amount of knockout games they've got to and got beaten in, the percentage is quite low. So that's a challenge for Leo, is when they come back from November, is to start to build that rapport. And if you think about their narrative after Northampton last year, Leo after the match was kind of hinted that the players shouldn't have been surprised by how Northampton played. But yet when you saw the performance, it was like they were shocked or whatever. So whose fault is it? Like, who's responsible to get the players to see the threat coming? Obviously the players have to take responsibility for it, but it's a collective thing, you know? And also I would say that they'll have to look at their ability to manage momentum at halftime or through substitutions. Because again, if you look at a lot of those knockout games they've lost, Leinster are brilliant when the opposition are on the hind tit and they're 10 points up. Like, they're very, very good at putting more scores on. But what I think the doubt is if you get into a battle with them, are they able to adapt mid-game? Are they able to regain composure? Are they able to come from behind? Like, the two La Rochelle defeats, halftime they're in control. But there's no point being in control at halftime if you don't close it out, you know? So they're the areas that I think Leo and his coaching staff will have to look at. Substitutions, I'm thinking back to the Northampton game. Ross Byrne came on in the 73rd or 4th minute. You know, could he, for 20 minutes, have come on and steered him home and experienced 10? Just one example. So, there's lots of question marks around Leinster. But they are better off having him now, as long as they find the right answers.
To flip it around and give Munster their flowers for the performance at the weekend, like, it wasn't as if they went out and everything went right for them from the first whistle. They conceded a try in the first 5 minutes. They pick up three injuries inside the first 40 minutes as well. And important enough players as well. Like, Edwin Odogbo goes off at halftime. They lost Dermot Barron at halftime as well. They lost Andrew Smith in the first 10 minutes. We mentioned Ty Byrne at the start of this podcast. Then you've Jack Rowley at out half, who just looks a completely different player to what he was 12 months ago. I know it was a controversial thing at the time when he got dropped for Sam Prendergast, but when you go back and look at it now, he was a player that was trying to do too much and trying to put the team on his back, whereas now he looks like someone who is still trying to do all those things, but the rest of the team are around him as well, and that's allowing him to flourish.
There are a couple of things about this. One is, this is all good for business.
Yeah.
Bad for Leo's business, obviously, because he's under acute pressure, but good for, if you're interested in Irish rugby, this is kind of stuff we want. Yeah. And the twist again in the race between Crowley and Prendergast is equally welcome. And I agree with you, Crowley did look frustrated and trying too hard and kind of lost. And Prendergast had been anointed by Farrell. Mm-hmm. And Farrell put him in and said, everybody was speaking about, like, you were at these pressers.
Yeah,
he's just so cool. Mm-hmm. He's unbelievably good under pressure. And what's he like about the place? Oh, he carries himself really well and blah, blah, blah. Look, Prendergast currently, and I know Birch knows him very well too, Ewridge, but currently he looks like he's a gifted footballer with a terrific passing game, limited athletic capacity and limited defensive aptitude or appetite. Mm-hmm. And he looks unhappy. He looks like he's making wrong decisions. Everything about him is going wrong. I'd say everybody looks better playing in a team that's going well. Sam is not looking very good in a team that clearly is struggling. And go back to the Northampton thing. Bert was talking about Leo saying, you know, the players shouldn't have been surprised. But, like, you don't need to be a tactical genius to know that if you're trying to beat a rush, you're going to double back and go the way you came. You're going to try to mix things up and not allow them get around the corner at you. And Leinster seemed to be just bewildered by the whole thing. And everything about that suggested poor preparation and not an insufficient respect for high performance. And in the book, I spoke to a guy who was involved on both sides of the house in Leinster, has a vast amount of experience. And I said to him, Jesus, were you not really rattled by that Saints game? Like, never mind the Bulls for a moment, just the atmosphere after that, the shock. And he said, I've been around I've been around the traps a long time now. I think I've pretty much seen it all, and I fully expect Leo to see out his contract. And I'm thinking, if Leinster hadn't done what they did in the mm-hmm. final against the Bulls, Leo was gone. Mm-hmm. And he may still be gone because Bert was talking about it for the last few minutes. There's an awful lot of things that need fixing, and he needs to figure out, am I the man to, can I fix this? And if he can't answer that positively, what's he going to do then?
Mm-hmm. The Munster tries, like, I think they just added to the occasion as well, because specifically the second and third tries, they were ones that actually just lifted the roof off the stadium. You have the inch-perfect Crowley kick and somehow Tom Farrell coming away with the ball and sprinting clear, and what a week it's been for him now, getting his Ireland call-up off the back of that. So deserved after he was called up in started 2020, was it?
Yeah,
but started 2019 when he was still with Connacht and missed out through injury, but this is his proper opportunity now. And then you've Ethan Coughlin's intercept. And as soon as he got that ball and raced away, I was bracing myself to look at the replay and go, he's surely offside here now. There's no way he got up that quick. And you see the replay and you go, oh no, try's good. Unbelievable. Like, just lifted the roof off the stadium.
Yeah, I spoke to him. So I'm fascinated by, from a tactical point of view, what do you do if you play Leinster? Mm-hmm. Like, and Northampton, as Brent said, they had a very good attacking plan, but you probably couldn't, you couldn't implement that, although they did have a couple of weeks prep for that game. But it's very similar to some of the things that they do most weeks. So with Sam Vesey, Northampton have a very good attacking strategy. With Finn Smith and Alex Mitchell, they have halfbacks who can adapt, etc. So they went in with a tailored game plan, and they have the power and pace out wide to exploit Leinster. And they obviously have Pollock, who has game-changing ability. Munster didn't play slavishly the Mike Prendergast attacking game. Mm-hmm. They were actually very happy to kick very early in the face play and turn Leinster and look for different opportunities. And even the Andrew Smith chip over the top where he does hamstring is a sign that they're not looking to just play phase, because they know Leinster get energy from smashing you off a touchline, etc. I actually thought the most remarkable try, or the one that would have given Munster confidence, was the first one, mm-hmm. Which is a simple tap move, whatever. But like, Gleeson, if you look at that again, the second phase of that, which Gleeson scores off, James Ryan's a pillar, RG Simons is an A defender, and Soroka's the B defender, right? And Soroka gets off the line, makes a good contact, which theoretically should stop behind the gain line, but RG is very soft on the inside, and James Ryan folds, okay? So they only have two in the collision, and Gleeson gets over. Like, that's a sign, like, that Leinster mentally weren't ready to defend with their bodies on the line. Mm-hmm. And then you got to hit them with something different. So the five-man line-out, win it over the 15, means that Leinster jumped the defensive line. So they're further up than they normally should be. It's a beautiful throw. And then obviously all the movement around Crowley and Abraham's swinging out the back, just interest low for a second longer than he had to. And then it's a perfect chip over the top. The intercept, you know, Coughlin, it's an individual moment, but it's based around giving your nine license to shoot there. You know what I mean? So,
and he nearly did it a while later.
Yeah,
as
no,
well.
Of course, yeah. Because yeah. But like, again, that's not something I've seen Munster nines do. I've been at the three Munster previous games this season. I haven't seen their nine shooting. So you're throwing something a little bit different at Leinster, who aren't expecting it. And then the last one again is a counter attack, the penalty try. But sorry, I spoke to an injured Munster player pre match, and I said, what are you going to do to try and beat Leinster tactically? Mm-hmm. And he said, actually, it's very similar to what we tried to do last year. We're just going to execute it.
Yeah.
And I went back and looked at the two games last year, and the kick strategy, the crossfield kicks, etc., the chip, they tried that before, but just didn't execute it. And again, it's also sometimes it's the new broom sweeping clean. McMillan comes in, and obviously they've made a few changes in their focus on their physicality and their fitness and their teamwork and all that stuff. But it's actually not being afraid to replicate what you tried last year and be able to say to the players, look, if we nail that. And also, like, you kick the ball over the top to Takir Abrahams and exploit that blitz defence. You know he's going to then stress Leinster because of his footwork and his pace. Whereas previously, not using a Munster player, but you could do that to another winger on a different team. Mm-hmm. And Leinster are very comfortable defending it, and then they smash you off the edge as well. So Munster now have some personnel who haven't been damaged by previous defeats to Leinster over a long-running period. So Odogbo has no fear of Leinster. Gleeson has no fear of Leinster.
Dan Kelly certainly does. Kelly was loving it. Perfect, yeah.
Abrahams is Ian Coughlan hasn't probably been in many 23s they've lost, yeah. You know, because he hasn't been there. So you've a young generation of Munster players now who probably, if you look at A results over the last couple of years, look at A result on Saturday.
Saturday, they come 26-0 back. Down, yeah, 26-0.
So I don't think they, I look at under 20s over the last couple of years, more Munster players coming in it. I'm not sure that they believe what we all believe probably too much, is that the Leinster Academy is just producing mm-hmm. world-class players every year. They have produced world-class players that are now coming towards the end of their career, their peak, but the next generation have to prove that they're as good.
I'll bring in Connacht here because I want to shift it to that Interpro at the weekend and where it gets interesting for Munster now. Clayton McMillan's first, pretty much his first press conference when he got the job in the summer. I'm going to pick out this quote. One of the key things he said he wanted to change about Munster: it's all well and good, and it almost seems to be ingrained in the Munster psyche that when our backs are against the wall or when we get into really big games that really matter, we have the ability to go to another level. And that's admirable, but we can't have those days and then the next week turn up and lose to a team that for all intents and purposes we should beat. That's why I'm looking forward to Munster against Connacht this Saturday
I'd say they were barely on the bus coming out of Croker, and they would have been saying, okay, that's done. Now we have to get our asses a gear and get our heads right for Connacht, which is not great news for Stuart Lancaster. But that'll be a fantastic occasion.
And on Connacht then, like, how do you look at that? They come from 25-14 down. They were poor for good, like, three quarters of the match pretty much, and they come away with two losing bonus points. On the flip side, they were a touchline conversion away from pulling off one of the heists of the season and coming away with a bonus point victory. How do you look at it?
First thing is with Lancaster. Lancaster's plan was to be in Sydney at this stage, just as the seasons are changing and the sun is coming out, and then that went bad. You know, he got ditched when he was going for the job, and he was sure he was going to get it, and then he was in a bit of a spin. Suddenly, Connacht came onto his radar, so he grabbed it with both hands. Galway, bit of a different scene to Sydney, heading into winter with a squad that doesn't have the resources of the other three. He's going to come under huge pressure now when the injuries kick in, and that is going to be really interesting from a personal point of view with him, because his last Irish experience has been largely comfortable dealing with so many resources. This is not what he's going to have on his plate now with Connacht. I would be unconvinced about the depth of the Connacht squad. Mm-hmm. The stories I was hearing early season coming out of there were that Lancaster was working them unbelievably hard and that the other coaches were struggling to get a little bit of air time because Lancaster was so much all over this. Now is the time for him to see if the changes he's making in their mental and physical attitude are going to come through. This is when it kicks off.
The worry is first couple of games, even though they lost against Cardiff, obviously over there, that defensive problems from last season looked pretty much tidied up.
Yeah.
But they got sliced open a handful of times on Friday night. And I know the Bulls are more than capable of doing that to anyone. But it was the first time this season you looked at Connacht and go, oh, they're getting carved open here.
Yeah, and they also were very badly beaten up at the scrum as well, which you could understand a little bit more. I'm disappointed because I actually don't think I would have expected their defence to continue to improve. Yeah. And they are spending as much time on defence as they are in attack. I think he'd be slightly disappointed. It'll be a bit of a wake up call in terms of what he has, because I think they have done a very good preseason. Mm-hmm. He has put a lot of things in place that he would have done with Leinster. He did commit to rotate the squad, but he had a strong team out on Saturday with Bundy and Mack and Finlay part of it as well. And there's no doubt there's less talent down in the depth chart than there was in Leinster. Remember with Leinster, he was able to rotate every week and it never looked like they're rotating, you know, but that's part of the fact that Leinster had a very settled team and an academy that was bringing through players, etc., for a long time. And he was able to, he was brilliant at running training sessions with 50, 55 players. So the academy players had already been exposed to what they want to do. And unfortunately now, if they don't get the result on Saturday in Thomond, it's been a very poor start when they targeted a fast start and
made even probably made even more frustrating with the postponed 100%. Game.
They probably would have won
because I think if they'd gone away and they'd won that match over in
Scarlets were coming to them.
Oh, Scarlets were coming to them. It was Ulster away to Edinburgh. Yeah. You know, if that game had been played, they get a win there. It's probably ever so slightly more palatable, the two defeats in a row. It just feels a little bit differently.
And they would have beaten Scarlets at home.
That extra game now is probably going to be crammed into an international break where you're not, you know, you might have a couple of extra players. You might be without a couple of extra players as well.
Yeah. Look, I've no doubt that Connacht will get a lot better under Stewart. I kind of hope they would get that kind of instant injection of belief that Clayton has got out of Munster because the fixture list wasn't that bad. Bulls at home isn't scary fixture, you know, and Cardiff away was a win that they definitely would have been targeting as well. So, but look, he's experienced enough to understand, you know, if you can't have a quick fix, you got to be able to work at medium and long term. I think he'll go to the transfer market heavy next summer. He probably already has reached out to players who've worked with him before.
Yeah,
and it was even interesting, like Dan Sheen. Did something with him for Goal last week, and he spoke about Stewart called him in one day and said, "You know, you're going to make it. You have it." And before anyone else saw it in him, and he said that was the turning point. You know, so Lancaster has worked his magic. I'm not saying Dan Sheen's going to go to Connacht, but he's worked his magic.
Oh, you were.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of players who've worked with him, or would believe that he can make him better. And I actually think this is, you know, last week's squad announcement was probably the pinnacle of discontent around Leinster bias or Leinster players in the Irish squad. I actually think it's gonna change over the next couple of years without a David Nussafour type figure having to get involved. I think a lot of those internationals are the wrong side of 27, and there's no guarantee that the replacements are going to come from Leinster.
Yeah.
Plus, I think you've got McMillan, Lancaster and Murphy now in the other provinces and creating their own success, their own culture. So the young players from those provinces have a better chance. And likewise, potentially, they'll be able to attract some of those fringe players from Leinster. And suddenly there's a greater spread and it's not as heavy towards Leinster as it was. But it comes from having really good coaches in the other three provinces and some youngsters coming through, the likes of Gleeson, the Dogbo, Devine, etc. Up in Ulster, Izichukwu, etc., who are as good as their counterparts in Leinster.
To bring it over to Ulster then, and in the, you were talking there about the getting the new coaching teams together, and you go through the potted history of Ulster, a checkered history in the last 15-20 years that's kind of happened up there. Now, Richie Murphy kind of went all in on his coaching ticket this year, got the band back together from the under-20s.
That's exactly
Didn't go all in financially with the coaching ticket, obviously, but went all in terms of his belief of what the coaching team he thinks is best. And it isn't the most high-profile coaching team in the world, but the early signs have been good, capped off with a very, very impressive bonus point win, albeit against an absolute bunch of chaos agents in the Sharks.
Richie had budgeted for a year of misery until he could get, as you say, the band back together. And it goes back to the 20s. And they trust each other. They know each other. They like each other. And they are absolutely crystal clear about what they're dealing with in Ulster, which is an under-resourced squad and no chance of changing it with bringing in huge hitters from overseas. So they have to make do with what they have.
Well, a pretty decent hitter in someone like Angus Bell now on the short-term deal later on this year.
Well, let's hope that works out because their recent history in that department has not been good. also, they know that going on in the background, David Humphreys is running around with his hair on fire trying to sort out the below the line, the school system up there, and trying to ramp them up. So Ulster, if you stand back and look at it, is not a well-resourced province in terms of finance or personnel. And Richie is relatively new to the head coaching role, so he's under pressure. I think he's doing a pretty good job. And
certainly doing a good job this season.
Yeah.
Three bonus points out of three.
Well, last season was in prep for this season. Putting systems in place, getting all of that, getting the team he wants around him. More than anything, he needs to keep players fit. If he can keep the group that he has currently on their feet, then he's a decent chance of continuing what has been a terrific start from, but it's how he's going to cope with the lads get banned.
Can I just say, you mentioned he's done a really good job this season. I think he has to. You have to actually give him credit for how he managed the tail end last season when they were losing.
Yeah.
Because
but
for an inexperienced coach at that level, a very experienced coach, he was able to keep the fans on side to a certain extent.
Yeah.
He was able to keep the board of management on side, the CEO, etc., the IRFU, and kept them understanding that it was worth it to wait for Mark Sexton, Willie Falloon, etc. He'd already brought Jimmy Duffy in.
Yeah.
But more importantly, to keep the players. So basically, like, the players are the ones who are losing their, losing some games, losing to Zebra away, etc. It's very easy to lose the head.
They're copping the abuse.
As a coach, that Monday morning or after the match. But they're the ones now he's working with now. And they've obviously understood that patience was worthwhile because some future was going to change. Augustus coming in, Angus Bell coming in, homegrown players coming through. So that's not easy to manage. You know, that's why people say, oh, go out and get, you know, these an Eddie Jones, a Warren Gatland, et cetera. And Eddie Jones maybe not so much, but who can actually handle the difficult periods and steer everyone through that. And Richie, for an inexperienced coach, was able to, I suppose, keep everybody on board. And now you're starting to get the results of it.
You were pretty confident of them going to the Sharks at the weekend, and that turned out to be fairly well placed confidence.
Yeah, I think
big payday.
I'd say John Plumtree would be lucky to survive till Christmas.
I think I might have said it last week. I can't remember, did I say it on the podcast or did I write it? But the Sharks are the greatest endorsement for Razzy Erasmus as a coach.
Yeah,
it's so much of these same players are just different players when they put on a Springbok jersey.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised he didn't throw his hand in at the end of the day. Like, I watched the post-match interview, I watched the game, and then I watched him running through there. We have to take a long, hard look at ourselves. And he was dipping a little bit into Leo's vernacular in sending not very, very veiled messages to the players, but it's inescapable that he hasn't been given those messages already, and they just ain't listening. They just weren't interested. The number of basic mistakes they were making simply because they weren't emotionally there. It just, if you're a coach looking at that, and this has been going on for a while, and they've been desperately inconsistent, you're asking yourself, can I fix this? Is it, what can I do to make this better? If I can't make it better, what am I going to do then? And I don't know, if Plumtree reckons he can still change this for the better, then I'd be very interested to see how he does.
Really clinical from Ulster.
Yeah, but from an Ulster point of view, like, they, you can see the celebrations at the end. They knew that was a milestone for them. Obviously, having now or have a chance of beating the Lions this week and like do the full three.
Kind of like, they've lost players obviously to the Ireland squad this week, some very important players, but three wins out of three, three bonus points out of three, already one bonus point win in the bag down in South Africa. Lions, like, they got a win at the weekend, but that was their first of the season.
Lions in front of 58 spectators.
It's a cracking free hit for us.
Yeah, it is. And if they can do that, they'll be in an unbelievably good position in the league, obviously, and then they go into Challenge Cup, they can
nice little break then after this weekend.
Rotate, rest players, Angus Bell coming after November, you know, fresh voice from there. But I think more importantly, they all look like on the same page attack wise and defence wise. Like, they just look really well organised, and hence, like, Nathan Doak's playing the best rugby of his life, and Jack Murphy, who's very talented, but is young, looks really comfortable, because if you look around them, and that's probably something you go back to.
At what point do we have to start talking about Jack Murphy as when should Andy Farrell be even bringing him into camp to have a look at him?
I'm surprised maybe he didn't bring him to Chicago like he brought a Dogbo. And I'm fascinated because like Sam at the moment, you have to be careful Harry Byrne doesn't take over from him in Leinster, because Leo has Leo's not going to be thinking
about development. Just be four out of halves now. We're flush.
But Leo's not going to be thinking about development at the moment.
Yeah.
Like, sorry, he'll always think about development, but it'll be short term as well. Like, who can help me win next week? And Harry Byrne gets a chance, obviously, you'd imagine, against Zebra. He was very good against the Sharks. But yeah, Jack Murphy definitely look. I think you get a real good sense looking at a team, how well coached they are and how organised they are by looking at their halfbacks, how comfortable they are. And that's probably like Gibson Park looked really shell-shocked and poor last week as well. Mm. And he's certainly not a poor player. For whatever reason, Leinster just weren't in sync. Whereas the Ulster are definitely in sync.
We'll have to put a pin in it there. We're running out of time. This week's games, Lions against Ulster, 12:45 on Saturday, as we said. What an opportunity that's for Ulster. And so much different to Connacht, where we said the psyche of the game in hand. It's probably not something Connacht want. Ulster are probably looking at that game in hand and laughing at the moment because they got three bonus point wins out of three. Leinster and Zebra then at 5:30, chance for Leinster to get back on the saddle. And then 7:45, probably the game of the weekend, Munster and Connacht at Thomond Park. A reminder, touching distance, Irish rugby's battle with Great Expectations out this week. Brendan Banning, yes. Good luck with the book.
Thanks a lot.
To borrow the Father Ted line, it's been great having you in.
Cheers.
Bernard, great as always.
And we'll now to Father Jack.
We'll speak to him. So my Google, Mike. We'll speak to you again soon. Thank you.